It's your ability to become the audience to your own performance. And we do this by asking three very simple questions. What do I know? What don't I know? And what do I think I know?
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, and behaviorism about curiosity and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Paul Ashcroft. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today I'm here with my co-authors, Simon Brown.
Hi, everyone.
And Garrick Jones.
Hi there.
And today we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Lauren Waldman. Hey, Lauren.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast.
I'm very excited to be here as a very curious person myself.
Yeah, us too. Hey, Lauren, let's dive right in. You are an expert in learning design informed by cognitive neuroscience, and you create scientifically designed learning programs from start to finish. So got to ask to start with, what is scientific learning design?
So scientific learning design is really about taking everything that we know about the brain, from how it processes information, how it attends to all the various stimuli that's thrown at us, how it focuses, and the very critical process of memory. And then pairing that with the methodologies and, you know, the strategic and intentional sort of methods and theories to help work with the brain as opposed to against it, which is what I often see in design. So, you know, the process is a lot more intricate than the way that learning is currently designed, but the quality and the results that we see become much higher.
And what are some of the results you see? You know, how does this improve how learning is designed?
Well, what we're seeing is it's not just within the design, is we're also seeing how it's improving the people on the other end and their abilities to learn. Because when we're scientifically designing, we're embedding in various practices and skills that are very fundamental. And I think we'll probably talk about these a little bit later when we talk about, you know, memory and metacognition and focus and attention. But the brilliance of being able to design like this is that we're not only increasing the efficacy of the design because we're trying to pair it more with the operational function of the brain, but we're able to give people on the other side who are doing the learning even more skills that they can build upon while they're doing the actual learning itself.
And Lauren, in the book, we cite some research from the University of California around how if we're actually curious at the point that we're learning, then that curiosity actually helps to create stronger memory. I'm really curious myself around from your research, you know, what actually helps us create better memories, or what helps us to learn better overall?
You know, I feel like I probably sound like a broken record, and I'm going to sound like a broken record by the time we're done here, but what helps us learn better is to really get us, you know, even at a fundamental level, an understanding of how the brain learns and how it does create those memories. You know, I think most of us, the majority of us who grew up in a traditional educational system, we were never taught these things. We all know how to learn. We are fundamentally built. Our brains are built to learn, but we definitely could be doing it a lot better. So when we think about what helps us learn better, it's not just about understanding how does the brain create a memory, but how does the brain process all that information that's coming up? And then we pair it with the methodologies and the theories. So when we think, for example, Simon, that focus is really your gateway to learning. And you need to be alert to do so, because this is what's going to trigger neuroplasticity. And that's the brain's ability to change. Now, I always joke that if you wanted someone to be alert before they learned, that you could just give them a really good scare. But we don't have the luxury of doing that in our organizational
settings. Okay, then you will go down well.
I mean, we could.
It's right in my wheelhouse. I love it.
I'm a big joker. And I think, you know, for those who have seen the series that I created, there are actually moments of me scaring people in the series. But, you know, it's not necessarily that tactic that you want to use, but what it would do is it prompts the release of epinephrine or adrenaline in the brain. which, you know, we want that because that chemistry is going to stimulate not only for us to be in a better position to learn, but it's also going to help with the memory process.
This is what I find so fascinating about your work, Lauren, is how it's focused on the neurochemistry, and your research comes out of neurochemistry. Can you tell us a little bit more about that research and how you understand neurochemistry impacts our learning beyond just a jump fright?
So this is a topic, Garrick, that I'm so intrigued by because, you know, when you get to see the inner workings of a brain, which most of us don't get the opportunity to do, what we discover is that there are so many mechanisms that we can't see that are governed by this chemistry. And I just want to make sure that everyone knows is that as a translator, this isn't my direct research. I'm doing all the translation of the research on behalf of the scientists. So this is research coming from all the global neuroscientists and the cognitive neuroscientists, like all around the world. But I'd say amongst the ones that I find the most fascinating when it comes to learning would be dopamine, which I think most people are familiar with. But then we've got acetylcholine, which is a little bit less familiar with everyone. So let's talk about dopamine for a second. Now, dopamine has this like long-standing reputation of being that feel-good chemical. And it is. It most certainly is. But the how and the why it impacts learning and how it conforms the way that we design, this is where it kind of gets really interesting. Now, dopamine is released when we encounter something pleasant or surprising. And it's part of the reason why the brain loves novelty so much. It's also when we talk about curiosity, right? It's all stimulated from that same sort of driver of this. We can have that dopamine and dopaminergic neurons. Those are cells.
We used to talk about the difference that makes a difference in learning. How can you create something which is different enough to get some attention? And I guess this is what the neurochemistry is doing. The brain is being triggered. You get a hormone release and it's the difference you're paying attention to. Is am I understanding that right?
Mildly.
Please help.
So let me give you an example. There was a paper I was reading, and there's a great example. There's a scientist, Rafal Bogzak, and in his paper, he gave this example about ice cream. And he says, if a new flavor of ice cream tastes better than you expected, it's going to release that dopamine. It's going to tell the brain, you know, this flavor is worth choosing again. So when we translate that over, you know, into learning and learning design, we can insert these very novel moments, like, you know, these unexpected moments into it. And it's really going to trigger that dopamine, which in turn, again, can contribute to the memory consolidation, which is what we're really after to do. But the air of caution, you know, when I'm working with learning designers and we're teaching them all these things, you get very excited about these, like, oh, I'm going to make this really cool and I'm going to throw in all these surprises and everyone's going to love my design. I said, okay, wait, because you got to be careful, because what happens when you overuse it, which again, I've seen too often, because people think we want learning to be fun, we want it to be engaging, which is true. But when you overuse it, what happens is the brain is going to start predicting, or in some cases is going to excessively start seeking it, which could derail what you actually want to be paying attention to. So you got to be cautious when you're playing around with the chemistry.
How does that relate to regulation, emotional regulation? And so how do our emotions and the regulation of the impact, the learning?
I think the better, honestly, Garrick, the better question to ask is, how do our emotions regulate everything? You know, we're humans. We feel things. I find it very useful for people to understand from a science perspective, what is the difference first between emotions and between feelings? So we can get a better context of what it is that we're working with. So if we know that our emotions are chemical responses, right? And this is very hard for us mere humans to conceptualize, that we're governed by chemistry and electricity and 3 pounds of, you know, meatloaf that we carry around every day. But our emotions are chemical responses. Now, it's chemistry being released that allows us to have a tangible, conscious experience of our feelings. So if we take something like stress, for example, I think all of us have felt stress at one point or another. And if you haven't and you're listening to this, please get in touch with me. I want to know who you are and how you're accomplishing this. But, you know, stress can be felt in so many different ways. And that response can be triggered by the stress hormone cortisol. Now, cortisol as the stress hormone, they're chemical messengers. And those get secreted into the blood and they can travel long distances into the body. But what it can do when it comes to as far as us being impacted by learning it can trigger a fight or flight response. And this is governed by our emotional processing centers in the brain called the amygdala. And basically what's happening is when that is triggered, there's another part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, which governs our executive function, which means our ability to focus, our ability to problem solve and goal set. Those two areas of the brain are highly connected by pathways. And when the emotional processing centers get overactive and we get to, you know, whether, let's say stress, for example, if we're having a stress response, there's an inhibitory pathway to your executive function. So you're going to go offline. There's going to be no learning happening at that point. So being able to downregulate ourselves, and we might be able to talk about a little bit of some of the ways that we can do that as human beings, is the fastest way that we're going to try to get our executive function back online. Because without it, we just can't learn.
And you said two chemicals. I might get the second one wrong, but you talked about dopamine already. But then did you mention acetylcholine?
Yes.
Is that what you were saying? Acetylcholine.
Acetylcholine, yeah.
Could you tell us about that as well? What does that do?
Yeah. So acetylcholine is really what's, it's more linked to our abilities to focus. And it's more of the, it influences our attentional control mechanisms. So attention is the mechanism that allows us to focus. So being able to tap into this and turn it on is a huge benefit. Now, there's very simple ways, because I know, again, it's very hard to tangibly sort of think, how do I release chemistry in my own brain? How do I do that? And as simple as it's going to sound, one of the ways that we can do this is just by simply, before you start working, before you sit down for a bout of learning, is you can stare at your screen, you can stare at the wall, but you try to hold that gaze for about 30 to 60 seconds. And this is a lot more challenging than it sounds. You know, focus is challenging, but it's more what's happening is you're getting what's called the top-down process. But when you're feeling that little bit of struggle, that's actually the neurochemistry being released. And it's kind of part of that process. So again, the series that we created, we've actually integrated these practices into it. And we show people, we're going to show you how to activate this and to work, you know, say joining forces with your brain. But we're also going to distract you a little bit just to show you how easily it is to get diverted.
Okay, now this is getting very interesting.
So, oh, just now?
It was interesting and now it's getting really interesting. Not meta-interesting, but let's not go there. Acetylcholine, and you have practices that can help you focus, one of which involves staring at a wall for 30 seconds because it creates a state in the brain and release. You also mentioned dopamine and cortisol. Do you have exercise related to those? I guess the regenerative ones you were talking about earlier can bring your cortisol levels down. But are there other, does your methodology relate to this? Do you use the neurochemicals? Do you introduce specific exercises within your learning programs to specifically take advantage of these?
I most certainly do. Most absolutely certainly do. Yeah. So one of the issues, and I think and I'm going to backpedal just a little bit. One of the reasons why I think that this is not done more is because there's a lack of translators for the scientists into practice. And so getting this into organizations, into learning design and everything is just a lot more challenging. So do I do it? Absolutely. Do I want to see a lot more people do it? Absolutely. So the insertion of things like we just talked about, the 30 to 60 seconds before. I mean, here's the catch, Garrick, is most people can't focus for very long because we don't recognize that focus is actually a skill. And it's a skill that we can cultivate. And it's a skill that we can work with. And it does require us to work more with the chemistry. So we can do the staring, the 30 to 60 seconds. There's fabulous research on using waves, so brain waves. So 40 hertz is sort of the ideal here. You can go onto YouTube. You can see brown noise, pink noise. I think there's black noise now, white noise. But you're really looking for 40 hertz. Ideally, you'd also want it to be a plain beat. You wouldn't want music playing in the background. But that one's going to stimulate in a little bit of a longer way. So you're looking to start that 30 minutes before you were going to go into work or you're going to start. So for myself, when I'm practicing, if I know I have to go into some deep research, if I know I'm going to be going to some deep design, I'm going to start listening to that 30 minutes before. And I might just be walking or grabbing a coffee or just, you know, putting myself in that place. But I'm actively working not only with the chemistry, but I'm working with the electricity as well. Now, when it comes to the stress response, down-regulating the stress response, there is there was latest research from a group of Stanford neuroscientists, and they looked at the difference between the different types of breath work that you can do in meditation. And what they discovered was that one of the sort of the best ways that you could sort of down-regulate very quickly was through what's called cyclic sighing. You know, this is not your typical, maybe some people listening have heard of box breathing. Box breathing is when you take four inhales, four exhales, you hold four exhales, and you kind of like envision a box as you're breathing. Whereas cyclic sighing, I can do a quick demonstration. I know people won't be able to see us, but you'll be able to hear it. Cyclic sighing is when we're going to inhale through our nose to the maximum that we can get to. And then right at the top, we're going to take another breath in. And then release that out. And what this is doing is we're working with our parasympathetic nervous system, but we're also working with things like our carbon and our oxygen. So it's having a very tangible effects on our bodies.
I've seen that deep sea divers do this, right? Who are doing the free diving. They do that to increase their oxygen capacity in their lungs before they dive in. Is that right?
Yeah. And I think what people I think don't realize is that because this has become very mainstream, like breath work, you know, meditation, like namaste, let's, you know, go sit in the forest and hold hands. But there's actual science behind it. And I think when you understand that this is having a physiological effect on you, it's activating different parts of your body and your brain. This is why it works. There is an actual practice, but you do need to be able to do it correctly.
So if I read the back, there's about 30 minutes before we go for the 40 hertz focus, looking at it on the web, looks like binaural beats seems to be the thing it's described as in what comes up. So we do that 30 minutes before that. That helps. Then 30 to 60 seconds staring, that's like right before, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then when we go into the focus work, then I know you also talk about encouraging sort of breaks and rest within the learning process. So tell us more about what happens once we actually start on it. We get the focus, we go into the learning. What then happens through the course of that in terms of then breaks and so forth? I've heard of the Pomodoro method in the past, a sort of 25-minute stints or so forth. But yeah, take us through that process, please.
So most people, when we're going into about of learning, it's like we usually dive headfirst. We don't even think about taking a break. We don't think about taking pauses. But there's a few reasons why we most certainly need to. And again, as we're also contextualizing this learning and learning design, it's important that we even learn to embed these breaks and pauses into the design itself so that we are practicing and teaching people to do that as well. Now, why do we need to take rest? Why do we have to take pauses? Well, first, the brain needs time to diffuse. It can't be in the focus mode all the time. First of all, it's exhausting. And from what we can see, as the research has shown, we can hold a good state of focus when, you know, we're doing something new for about 90 minutes. We don't want to pass that threshold. And during those 90 minutes, you're going to get distracted. It's going to happen. But the brain needs to diffuse first to make connections and build upon existing networks. So whether that's we're using our scaffolding effects within our own brains, we need that time for that process to happen. But next, it is beyond well researched at this point that sleep or non-sleep deep rest. This was a term coined by Andrew Huberman at Stanford. NSDR is really what the brain needs in order to consolidate memory. And it's so fascinating, Simon. I had the honor and the privilege of being able to see some live fMRI footage where they injected a phosphorescent dye into the brain so you could see, you know, pathways. And it's absolutely phenomenal when you see what a brain is doing when it's sleeping. But one of the coolest things that I learned when I was first studying memory and all of this, and it stuck with me to this day, was that sleep is the only time that we are remembering and forgetting at the same time. It is so impactful to sort of think about it that way. So that's kind of like the larger consolidation of when we're learning. So to sort of, you know, put the expectation on anybody whether you are a student in school, whether you are an employee in an organization, to say, we're going to send you to an 8-hour day of training. You're going to go into a 4-hour day of this, or go do 3 hours worth of e-learning, and we'll get to you tomorrow and see how great you did.
It still doesn't work.
It doesn't work. Now, the cool thing is, when it comes to design, is when we insert small pauses, this is a very, I'm going to get really, really nerdy with you guys right now. When we insert these really small pauses into the design, because again, we want to encourage people to stop. And if anyone who's been in a workshop or a keynote or anything with me, I'm doing this the whole time, is what we're seeing, little pauses has been shown to allow for neural repetitions.
Is that sort of 30 second pauses or even smaller?
No, these are little 10 second, little micro 10 second pauses. And when we're getting in these 10 second pauses is when we're learning, what we're doing is we're stamping neurons, we're stamping cells to activate in a certain way. It's kind of like a connect the dots, right? And once we have all those dots connected, we can see the picture. But with the brain, it's these neurons and we're stamping them. Now, when we take these little pauses, it can be as small as just 10 seconds. What research has shown is that these neurons are being reactivated in the same pattern up to 10 times during those breaks.
We're talking to Lauren Waldman. Lauren is the founder and learning specialist of Learning Pirate. Having studied at Harvard, Duke, and Johns Hopkins University, she launched Learning Pirate in 2017 in order to help individuals use their brains to their full potential and to optimize learning, work, and overall life quality. So, Lauren, I've got a question about confidence. And how does confidence and this neurochemistry understanding impact decision-making and learning? I'm really interested in decision-making. I think it has a relationship to learning. But how does this interaction between this chemistry and confidence impact the learning?
I think when it comes to confidence, again, when we are confident and when we have that sensation, when we have that feeling, it's going to activate different neurochemistry versus if it could be the difference between having a bit of dopamine and serotonin and all these wonderful, the happy neurotransmitters going through versus the high levels of cortisol or norepinephrine, where your stress response, where again, Garrett, that bear's chasing after you. I know I keep picking on you, but when it comes to confidence as well, I think what we also can sort of lean on is the growth versus the fixed mindset, the work of Carol Dweck, which was absolutely brilliant. Right. So when we encounter a challenge or when we encounter an error, does it trigger us to have the stress response, which is going to release that cortisol? And it's going to release. And maybe it is. And a little bit of stress when we're learning, we actually want it. It's good. It's when we pass that threshold that it becomes bad.
That's fascinating. It's the idea that you should be in a happy environment and everything should be safe and secure is not really where we have optimal learning. And that's borne out by the neurochemical response you're suggesting. That's amazing. It changes the way that we are going back to designing learning in a way. I mean, it fascinates me that we can design a learning program that is optimally sharpest pencil in line with the way the brain works, the neurochemicals, and what we're doing, because it means we can learn stuff without being stressed out by it. It means we can learn stuff in bite-sized chunks. And it can be optimal. It's going to stay in place. And that's important for both decision-making and also learning. Do you think, what about curiosity? Where does curiosity come to play in this, the game of neurochemicals and learning and the neurological point of view?
I mean, curiosity is, I think when we originally spoke, I am one of the most curious people. If I see something shiny down a dark alley, I'm going to go see what that's all about. I just need to know. But it's interesting because, it stimulates the neurochemistry in the same way that novelty does. There was a cool study done in 2014 that I was looking at by Gruber and colleagues. And what they did is they measured the brain activity while people were answering trivia questions. And they rated their curiosity for each question. Now, what they showed during the experiments, what they were doing, so they got these questions, but they were also interleaving photographs of either neutral faces or unknown faces. And that kind of acted as the probe for learning. Now, when these people were tested later, what they saw was they recalled faces shown in high curiosity trials better than they were in low curiosity trials. So that curiosity state actually did lead to better learning, even for the things that the people were curious about. So that was curious in itself. But what they saw was the curiosity drove activity in midbrain, which had dopamine regions in them, and another place called the nucleus accumbens. Now that's more, you know, the dopamine, but it's also memory. So we were correlating this with areas of the brain. Some people might know the hippocampus. It's sort of best known for episodic long-term memory. And it was activating these parts of the brain. So when it comes to curiosity, again, it's wonderful to want to chase that and to be able to design learning in such a way where we are guiding people to continue to chase that curiosity, but not overdo it, like I said. You know, if you're constantly searching for Waldo, you're not paying attention to what you're supposed to be learning.
It's great that your research also confirms the research that we did for the book, that actually, if we're curious at the point of learning, it does actually aid retention. That's fantastic. How do we monitor our learning? So, you know, as you've given us the techniques for sort of how we space out the learning and how we prepare for the learning, but how can we be more aware sort of through the learning process of what's going on and monitor whether we're being effective or not?
This is a phenomenal question, because this comes down to a very old theory and method that has now been, you know, over the course of, 40 years or so, been updated. So first of all, Simon, I'm going to answer by this. Most people don't monitor their learning, and that's part of the big problem here, because they don't have the, you know, they don't think about how am I going to monitor it while I'm doing it. Again, we were never taught to do any of these things. Now, when we look at metacognition and metacognitive theory, this goes back to 1975 in the work of John Flavel. There's another John, Professor John Zanlowski, who was a mentor of mine, and he researched this for over, you know, 30 years. When it comes to our abilities to be metacognitive, and for those people who are listening who don't know what this theory is, I'll describe it very simply as I do, as it's your ability to become the audience to your own performance. So how do you become the audience to your own performance? For my learning designers listening, how do we help somebody else become the audience to their own performance? And we do this by asking three very simple questions. What do I know? What don't I know? And what do I think I know? And we want to do this at the beginning of the process and as we are going through it as well. For my learning designers, what I would encourage you to do is, because we know that people will sit down and they will try to get through that learning as fast as they can so they can get back to, you know, their Amazon shopping or, you know, the donuts in the kitchen at the meeting. What we really want to do is we want to embed those moments for them. And we want to be a little bit tricky. And we want to do this for ourselves as well. Stop when you're learning and go back. Try to answer one question for yourself. Do I really know that, or do I think I know that?
Is that then tied also to the sort of notion around sort of conscious incompetence and so forth? So I guess, what am I consciously competent of? That's the stuff that I know. What am I consciously incompetent at? Stuff that I'm conscious that I don't know. And then the unconsciously incompetent, where I don't know that I don't know it. those concepts around.
Yeah, it is. I think so this is the beautiful thing about our brains and how they can work against us, is when we are learning something that is, maybe it's similar to something that we've already learned. So we've got the memories in there. They're already encoded in there. What happens is that it will always revert back to what it already knows. So it becomes a challenge for us to, and I think when we think we already know it, it will bypass it. So really embedding those moments where you have, first of all, if you encounter a moment where did I really not know that? Well, what's going to be your next strategy and what's going to be your next method? Now, this is another thing that I see that, again, none of us were ever taught. We aren't taught to think about, when I'm going to sit down to learn, do I have a strategy? Do I know a variety of different methods that I can sort of reach into if what I'm currently doing isn't working? And the answer to that, unfortunately, is mostly no.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
So, Lauren, we've covered what we can do with the 40 hertz sounds, sort of 30 to 60 minutes. We've done the sort of 30 seconds of focus at the beginning of a piece of learning. How then, as we go through the learning, do we actually monitor whether we're being affected? So how do we know whether the learning is working, whether we're actually capturing or taking in what we want to be taking in?
Well, the first thing that I think that a lot of people need to recognize is that we don't do this at all. Mostly we start the learning, we dive in, we click the buttons, we take some notes, but we don't actually stop during the process to see am I actually, you know, learning what I'm supposed to be learning. And again, I think this is also a problem with the way that things are designed, is they're mostly designed that way. So you get to the end of the learning and then you go to see if you remember anything or if you created the memory for it. Now, the most effective way to monitor your learning is to embed some skills from the realm of metacognition. And metacognition, for those who don't know, like I said, the way that I like to describe it is becoming the audience to your own performance. And whether that we're doing it for ourselves or for my learning designers listening, it's if you can take the opportunities to figure out for the other person who's doing the learning, how do I help them become the audience to their performance by embedding the opportunities for people to ask themselves while they're going through the three critical questions of what do I know? What don't I know? And what do I think I know? That last one is the most critical, you know, because during the learning, because when we think we know something, we're going to keep going. That's the way that the brain works. When something is very similar in the brain and we're learning something that might sound a bit similar, it's going to start to bypass things. When we stop and we ask ourselves, do I actually know that? And we insert a way to quiz ourselves or to retrieve the memory. That's when you're going to find out, do I really know this and can I transfer it? Or I don't know this and I have to look somewhere else. But Simon, when it comes down to, you know, someone sitting down to learn, it's those things that we never learned in our traditional educational settings. No one ever said, hey, here's a treasure chest full of all these different methods and all these different strategies that you can use while you're learning. And if you get stuck in one place, go back to that treasure chest and find a different method. We don't know those things. We were just never taught them. So understanding skills like metacognitive strategies and how that is also part of a skill and looking at what are my strategies and what happens when I do encounter a problem or an error? How do I pivot? We like to use that word a lot in business. How do I pivot? But how do I pivot in my learning?
This sounds like, Lauren, one of the kind of, I know you talk about habits and how you keep yourself motivated, engaged in learning over time. You know, fitting it in is one thing, but staying motivated, engaged. What are some of the other habits that you recommend when you're designing learning for people?
Oh my gosh, where do we even, Paul, that's like a whole week. So,
maybe
that's
it's
like
up
a whole week worth. I think, you know, definitely that one. So let's dive in a little bit further, right? So when we look at the work of metacognition in detail, it's, like I said, it's a way to monitor and regulate what you're thinking. That's where the theory really comes down to, is like, it's called thinking about what you're thinking about. So if we're able to monitor our thought processes in the moment, which is incredibly hard, because when we go back to what we were talking about at the beginning, which is our attention and our focus, well, in order to even pause in the moment, you have to be able to stop and think, okay, am I just reading this page and very passively doing so? Or am I in that page? Now, most of us will read through a page of a book and we'll just keep going. We don't stop and go back to the top page, right? It's the top of the page to say, did I really learn that? Or did I really absorb that? Because remember, you're not learning anything within about a few hours, right? You've got to really practice that. So that whole embedded skill of monitoring, regulating, having your strategies, knowing some methodologies, and being able to pivot is one of them. The next one is, if we want to work with our brain, that means we can't work against it. So if I'm sitting there and I'm trying to do something and I'm getting bored and I'm hungry and I want to get up and that's where my brain is taking me, well, I'm probably going to want to do one of those things, because a lot of the times we try to push through, and that's working against our processes, right? So don't push through. And you're just increasing that stress response. And like, what do we know? You've got your stress response, your executive function's going offline. So set that environment for yourselves as well. We talk about this a lot, again, in the journey that I do through joining forces with your brain. Another one. So I think a lot of people in our industry, they know about the proper, or they don't know about the proper use about spaced and spaced repetition and interleaving. There is proper use for these things. And that's a whole other podcast in its own. But I'm going to offer something new, which is the work of Elizabeth and Robert Bjork, who are absolutely brilliant. They're out of UCLA. They've been at this for well over 30 years, and they talk about desirable difficulties. And within that, it's also, we're talking about learning the difference between storage strength of memory and retrieval strength. Now, the storage strength is going to be a reflection of how entrenched or how interassociated a memory is related to the knowledge or the skills. Whereas the retrieval strength is going to reflect that current active, sort of the activation or how accessible it is. And we don't think about that. So I would encourage, like, again, think about those things. What's my storage strength versus my retrieval strength? If it's not stored, can I retrieve it? Probably not. So all of these little, you know, methods add up over time. And really, it's a matter of if we can use this knowledge to design more effectively, but we can also use it as a learning strategy in our own processes.
And straight away, I don't think we have the time to answer it, but I encourage everyone to explore how can I improve my story strength and how can I improve my retrieval strength, because it's something that I'm going to go and try and figure out. But otherwise, look it up on your research, I think.
So I had a tangential question, taking us off in a different direction, but you've talked about treasure chests, and you're known as the learning pirate. So tell us about where did the learning pirate piece come from?
Oh boy. Well, funny enough, the pirate is driven by my own curiosity. I think I've always, ever since I was a little girl, I think there's a picture of me when I tried to commandeer my parents' station wagon, and my sister is like my co-pirate. I think I was maybe that's a 4-year-old little Lauren. No, that comes with the curiosity side of things. But when I started the company, having been in the industry, having been in learning for a very long time, and then having learned everything that I started to learn about neuroscience and the brain, I knew I was going to have to come in and shake things up a bit. And, you know, pirates are kind of known for that. So we come in, we disturb a little bit, but all for the good sake of having a good adventure. So that's where the pirate came in. And I think, honestly, Simon, I don't even think a lot of people know my real name, because when I go to conferences nowadays, they're like the pirates here. And I'm like, hello. And that's fine. I don't care if you don't know my name, but if you know what I do and you support the science, then that's all that matters.
So Lauren, you just mentioned shake things up in learning. One thing that's shaking things up in learning is artificial intelligence, and particularly the Gen AI stuff. Do you have a view on that? What are you seeing some of the implications of that on learning?
You know, I think it's, first of all, the first thing I'm seeing is somehow everyone has become an expert in it overnight, which is incredible, because they somehow managed to bypass the memory process in their own brains and they know it all. But what I think when it comes to the implications of AI on learning is, honestly, Paul, it's too early to tell. It's way too early to tell. We need more. We need, you know, people to actually engage with it. We need to be able to design with it. We need people to actually go through learning with it. And then we can start making some bold claims on the efficacy of using AI. I've seen some great examples. I also seen some absolutely horrible examples. But I think we should also be a little bit more concerned, I think, from the science perspective, the educational perspective, is we're looking at the implications of AI on executive function and our abilities to be more discerning and, you know, our abilities to problem solve a little bit, you know, more, because we're trusting a lot of what's being put up in front of us, but we already know unfortunately, if you don't know the knowledge, how can you verify if it's true? So in some cases, we're seeing that although AI is really wonderful for some things, it's causing a lot more work because you have to keep going back and verifying if you're doing your due diligence.
So we've covered a huge amount there, Lauren. So scientific learning design, critical processes of memory, how we need to work with the brain, not against it, how we can improve our ability to learn, how the brain creates memories and the importance of focus. You've taken us through a whistle-stop tour of neurochemistry around dopamine, acetylcholine, and various other brain chemicals. We've learned about the prefrontal cortex. We've learned some techniques around how we can prepare with 40 hertz sound 30 minutes before learning, stare at a screen 30 to 60 seconds at the beginning of our learning, and then some techniques to actually help us focus and go through, including some breathing techniques and things as well, and keeping to not more than 90 minutes max to be able to keep that focus. Talked about micro pauses, those 10-second pauses to stamp the neurons, a bit then on growth mindset versus fixed mindset, and more around the different parts of our brain, the benefits of curiosity on actually aiding our retention, as well as what caused you to be known as a pirate from hijacking cars at a young age. So from all of that, if there was one thing that you would leave our listeners with as a takeaway, what would that be, Lauren?
Well, I'm sorry for overloading your brains. First of all, let's go take a go get something to drink.
We're all ready for a pause.
You know, there are so many ways to join forces with your brains, and we often work against them. We just don't know it. And I find that it's valuable to find either scientists, you know, there's not many of us who are also practitioners, who can help navigate that journey, you know, and who can help to navigate the journey of not only understanding your brain a little bit better about the learning design, the science, but we help you be overall versions of yourself and how you show up. So as much as I talk about the brain, as much as I talk about the neuroscience of it all, what we're really talking about is those beautiful fundamental things that make us humans that no one just ever taught us.
That's a lovely way to close a very, very fascinating conversation, Lauren, and to think that actually the main thing is to activate what's inside of us already. And thank you so much for giving us all these really practical and fascinating tips for how to do that. I really appreciate you joining us for this conversation. Thank you. You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today at #CuriousAdvantage. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, or audiobook copy now to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast.
The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon.
Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.